This is A Cultural History Of, with Miranda Garrett and Chesky Pesier. Like homework, but drunker.
Hello, and welcome to A Cultural History of Tidiness. I'm Miranda Garrett.
I'm Francesca Pesier.
And today we're joined by actor, clown, and theatre maker Lauren Silver.
Hello!
And Lauren is really passionate about being tidy. Lauren, is tidy, have you always been tidy?
I think an early memory of probably my turning point of going from being very messy to very tidy was when I was growing up and we had a cleaner. We were very lucky in my house, we had a cleaner, and my mum used to have a rule of saying, you know, when the cleaner's round, you need to basically tidy so that the cleaner can clean the room. And I never used to do that, probably, because I was quite lazy. And I remember coming home and being like, oh, my room's really clean and really tidy and all my stuff's gone away. And then getting into bed, I'm sort of sitting on the bed and being like, whoa! And basically what had happened was my mum had instructed the cleaner to put all of my belongings, not just in my bed, but under the bottom sheet. So that I was like tricked into thinking that the room was really tidy and that actually that everything had been hidden in my bed. That's the sort of room that my poor mother is. So I think
you
that
were
was,
emotionally scarred by
I
that.
I've been emotionally scarred. This has become a therapy session too early.
Already. We've only just started.
Can we talk about the god that is Marie Kondo?
Yes, we can. We love her.
Just for anyone who's listening to this and they don't know who Marie Kondo is. Marie Kondo is the Japanese author of the runaway hit, The Life-Changing Magic of Tidying Up. Oh. The English translation says, gives you joy. Mm. And she has a gesture for joy, which I'm going to do now, which won't work for the podcast.
We can describe it. Oh, it's lovely. It's as though she's doing a My Little, I'm a Little Teapot.
Exactly. Yeah. It's a little teapot with joy.
Yeah.
This is the opposite.
Oh, she's sad. Looking sad.
Yeah.
Head down.
But literally translates in the Japanese as, don't have anything in your house that doesn't make your heart twinkle.
Mm-hmm. Oh, twinkle?
Yeah, really.
Although
does.
That sounds biologically worrying if your heart is twinkling.
My boyfriend and I went round to our friends Sam and David and I was like, what is this book? I've heard about this book. And their eyes changed, like something weird happened to their face and they were like, do you know about KonMari? And I was like, okay, this is slightly something weird's gonna happen. But they sat and talked at us for about, and they're lovely guys, but they talked for a passionately long amount of time about this Japanese woman and her ways, and I was like, okay, so it's a bit. But then I got her book and I read it and I was just like, oh my god, like this actually makes complete sense to me.
So can you give us a brief run through of the philosophy?
Okay, her basic principles are that you organize it into your life into five categories. I mean, ultimately, she's a life coach, so she comes around to people's houses and sorts themselves out, is what she does, is she'll come round and she'll do things for people. But she is, what I really like about it is, I don't like the fact that I own a lot of stuff. I feel like it becomes quite stressful if you spend a lot of money on things and you become very materialistic, but then you don't know what you've got.
Things are my favourite.
It's good to have things, but how she feels is that you should fully appreciate everything that you have, is basically what it is. You only own things that spark joy. I really feel like I've got that glint in my eye where I'm like, oh, you haven't heard of Marie Kondo? Let me tell you.
Just for the listeners, Lauren does look a little bit possessed at the moment.
But I feel like she's
her hair's gone sort of standing up. She's getting a bit sweaty.
But I love her.
I want to ask a question before we get into the main thing. Do we think tidiness is gendered? Because there's been a lot in the news recently about emotional labour.
Yeah.
And how women undertake emotional labour of running the home, of remembering to do things, of clearing the table, changing the loo roll, all the little things we remember to do. Do we think tidiness is a female trait?
I don't know. I grew up in a military household. My dad was in the army, so I feel like my perception of this is going to be skewed because he was so organised and so tidy that I don't feel like there is a gender balance, but perhaps that's not the everyday experience.
What about in your household? Have you brought Stuart round to your ways? Are you equally tidy?
I think he's had... So Stuart's a graphic designer and he's very They've been very inspired by sort of minimalist Japanese.
Marie Kondo.
Not even her. He is.
He probably loved my new favourite word, which is nolling.
Oh. Nolling. Is that with a K?
You're the K.
Yeah.
Oh. The joy of arranging things at right angles.
Oh.
So, you know, like Instagram photos where everything's perfectly lined up and parallel.
Yeah.
That is to null. It's nolling.
What's the etymology of that?
I have no idea, but it makes me ecstatic.
Because it has a word. I think my mum was very tidy. My mum is a very tidy person, but she has a lot of stuff over the years. She's not very good at, like, condensing clutter, but it's all got its place.
So Chesky and I have gone away and done some research, and we've each come up with some interesting facts about the cultural history of tidiness. We're going to pitch them to Lauren in three rounds: historical, cultural and social, and theoretical. And at the end of the episode, Lauren will get to choose whether Chesky or I have been more interesting.
You're going down, William Morris.
And she will crown the winner, the cultural historian of the month.
So the first round we have to introduce to Lauren is the historical precedent for tidiness. And I think you're going to kick us off, Miranda.
Yes, I certainly am. So I wanted to talk to you about books. Because as a historian, I've got a bit of a passion for them. I will buy a book on anything. Absolutely anything. So for the doing research for this podcast, I thought, oh, I'll go on Amazon, see if anything good comes up. I bought three books on the history of Victorian sewage, which I'm really excited about. So I probably describe myself as a collector of books rather than a hoarder, but some of my flatmates might disagree. And I thought I'd switch this around and I'd look into the literary history of hoarding. Is that anything, something you know anything about?
No, nothing.
Okay. So I look back and the earliest reference I found was actually from Dante and his 14th century poem, The Inferno, where hoarders were condemned to the fourth circle of hell, where they were doomed to battle with wasters by crashing heavy stones against each other. And the stones meant to apparently symbolise their attachment to physical wealth. So I think Marie Kondo would get on board with that.
She would.
But most of the examples I found were from post-industrial revolution. Another one I came up with was Gogol's Dead Souls from 1842, where there's a landowner called Plyuskin. My Russian's not great, so I'm probably pronouncing that wrong. And he filled his manor with rubbish. Locals would call him the fisherman for his habit of fishing around the neighbourhood for, and this is a quote, an old soul, a bit of peasant woman's rag, an iron nail, and a bit of broken earthenware. All highly collectible items.
All items Miranda currently has.
I know. So many of those things.
Oh, it makes me so stressed.
But the Russians have taken it to heart. So the hoarding disorder is known as Plyuskin syndrome in Russia, which I thought was very interesting. There are examples in British literature as well. Dickens included a hoarder in his 1862 novel Bleak House. Do you know the one I mean? It's Nemo and Miss Flight's landlord Crook, who's described as possessed with documents, which I thought was a really descriptive term, in a store where everything seems to be bought and nothing sold. He also drinks a lot of gin and then dies of spontaneous combustion, so I'm totally on board with him. So then I thought, I wondered about whether book hoarding is an actual thing, and it turns out it is. And fortunately for me, it's got a historical precedent as well. Bibliomania is called.
Oh, that's amazing. Yeah.
And it swept through the upper classes in England in the early 1800s. And there are various different theories about why it became a thing, but most people agree it was after the French Revolution and all the libraries of French noblemen came on the market when they tried to free France. But it became this sort of medical condition where people were getting so obsessed with it. And there's a real watershed moment in the 1812 auction of the library of the third Duke of Roxburgh, which generated such fierce bidding wars that it went on for 42 days and ended in a duel.
Oh, all good things do.
I was going to say.
I know. Can you imagine people now around Waterstones?
With shanks.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So exciting. So the condition, it wasn't ever medically recognised, and it still isn't now, although I think it's a subcategory of hoarding disorder. But it was documented most famously by the beautifully named Reverend Thomas Frognall Dibdin, himself was a victim of the neurosis. And he called this fatal affliction, he said it was, and he called it the book disease. And he wrote a book about it, which I think beautifully has now become a really highly sought after collector's item, adored by bibliomaniacs. So that was the cultural precedent for tidiness that I wanted to pitch to you.
Brilliant.
I mean, that was good. I'm not going to lie, that was pretty good. I love a duel over a book.
I mean, it's just a duel.
Okay, yeah. So I'm going to counter you, Amanda, with...
Good luck.
Extreme minimalism. So
you're playing to Lauren's strengths.
Exactly.
There.
Well,
yeah, you know your audience.
Well, I don't know. It all gets a bit dark. But what are the philosophical roots of owning less things, and is it truly good for us? Extreme minimalism can be classed as asceticism, dedicating yourself to self-improvement through abstinence. It also allows for the realization that nothing is permanent, and that holding onto objects only leads to suffering, as you have not accepted that their existence and your ownership of them is fleeting, as is your own life.
Oh, God.
Minimalism can expand beyond stuff you own to doing less, eating less, and producing less stuff. The idea is trying to tread lightly on the world, minimal harmful impact, and then the things that you do choose are thorough and focused. So everything you put your time into, every meal you make, everything you do, everything you own is considered. You've thought it through as an action. You should strive to do one thing at a time and complete it thoroughly. Wouldn't that be nice? Just one thing at a time. Randa does not agree. Her face is amazing right now. However, I must advise caution. Asceticism in the extreme can lead you to more painful purification, such as self-harm, as self-flagellation, or washing only in cold water. And finally, the ultimate, and again, my Japanese pronunciation is not great, you might be tempted into sokushinbutsu. Sokushinbutsu is extreme asceticism practiced only by Buddhist monks that leads them to mummify themselves while still alive. This is achieved by eating only tree bark, seeds and pine needles, and giving up liquid except for a soapy tea containing a lacquer that kills flesh-eating bacteria and acts in a similar manner to embalming fluid. When you are about to die, your monk colleagues would pop you in a tomb and listen for the chanting to stop, and then they'd warm you up in there, assuming you were dead. I mean, this whole process took about 3 years. For you to slowly give away everything and give up everything and eat only trees until you reach this point. They then check back on you in a couple of years to check you were mummified and ready for the altar. And not so much worship, but, you know, total respect that you had achieved this ultimate transcendence through your total minimalism. But if your body was rotting, no worship for you. Just pop you off into the mass grave. Does that make your heart twinkle?
No.
So now Chesky and I have both presented our cultural precedents for that. Do you have any questions or one thing you'd like to raise?
I'm just fascinated by how yours, Chesky, went from minimalism to mummifying. Like, how...
Well, we've all known from the past cultural history of if I can bring it back to a corpse,
you will go there. Yeah,
I just love creepy shit. I can't help myself.
It's funny because also I know quite a few people that have the
bibliomania.
Yeah, I actually because I don't own a lot of books, but I know a lot of people. I'm very much like, I have a book and then I will give it away almost. I love those little books, those little libraries and train stations.
Talking about libraries, can I tell you about Dr. Alois Pichler?
Please
do.
Okay, so he was a librarian at the Imperial Public Library in St. Petersburg, a big deal. And then a couple of months after he took his position, other staff, this is in the 19th century, started noticing that he was acting a bit weirdly. You know, he'd be leaving things in funny places, being a bit odd. Books started disappearing from the collection. they suspected him. They searched his house and they found 4,500. 4,500 stolen library books on absolutely everything, from perfume making, theology, whatever it was, he had it. And it's the largest library theft ever on record. And he was put on trial, and his lawyer tried to defend him by saying he had bibliomania. Didn't come off, because it's not an actual thing. And he was found guilty and exiled to Siberia.
To Siberia?
Yeah.
I'm sure they've got books.
I think they do now.
They do. Yeah.
But
God, his library bill would have been huge. Yeah. Imagine. But I know quite a few people that have that. I know a lot of people that have that as an actual, you know, an obsession to buy that many, to own that many, those many books, because they feel so emotionally attached. I can't go back to it, but once I've read it, I'm feeling the same way about films. I've watched a film, I can't watch it again.
I'm less likely to keep novels, but anything referenced, because it'll be useful.
Yeah.
Can I really justify the Victorian sewage systems? The three Victorian sewer books that I
feel like you could.
As research for this podcast as well.
I feel like you would use that again somehow. I feel like also you would retain that information.
I'm going to make it my mission.
That could be, I don't know.
Can I have a quick thing on sort of other famous minimalists?
Mm-hmm. Yes, please.
Because I was looking at a dear old, one of my favourite philosophical pun.
But my personal favourite is Diognis, who was massive in the founding of cynicism as the Greek philosophy. And that just makes me even more happy because I love a good cynic. But he apparently gave up all his possessions to live in a wine jar. I think that's great.
I find it, dude, a friend of ours, Ed, he gave away every single piece of everything he owned, apart from like a pair of pants.
I dated a guy who did something really similar, and again, he was a musician, and he would living in a squat, and I went round, you know, for romantic candlelit wine dinners, and we'd just be sitting in his empty squat with no staff and mice running everywhere.
There's something
that
falls romanticism to
it
as well.
But it was just horrid, and he was, with the little possessions he did have, he managed to make a big mess.
The cultural history of Overthinking Things since 2016.
So, Lauren, the next section of cultural history we'd like to present to you is the theoretical precedents for tidiness. And I'm going to kick us off with a pun. Oh, I love a pun.
I love a pun.
Do you have some other Freudian choices for tidiness? No, only two, anal Freud.
I'm afraid.
A not so nice term for lovely tidy folk is anally retentive, which is all because, of course, of everyone's favourite misogynistic penis worshipper, Freud, and psychosexual development. The anal stage of psychosexual development is the second stage, coming directly after oral at about ages 2 to 4. Freud reckoned that the anus was the primary erogenous zone and pleasure was derived from controlling the bladder and bowel movements. Your first true resistance to authority is having to poop tidily where your parents tell you during toilet training. If you are too uptight about your bodily functions, then this leads you to having a controlling and neurotic personality. Anally retentive people are stubborn, good with money, hate mess, obsessively tidy, punctual and respectful to authority. It's the lesser known counterpart of being anally retentive. So to be anally expulsive is what happens if you are allowed too long to shit wherever you please, and you become messy, disorganised, rebellious and very inconsiderate, which is not surprising if someone's allowed to poo wherever it is they want, that they would be quite an inconsiderate person. It's not encouraged at parties. Depends on the party, to be fair. Anal retentiveness has been largely dismissed as pop psychology, especially since indoor plumbing. So basically, because Sigmund Freud had a thing about constipation and having to queue for the toilet as a child, he decided that's what made people neurotic, is they just really needed to go to the loo and enjoy having a poo.
All that rye bread.
It's all that rye bread.
I love rye bread.
However, it's found our way into our daily slang. It's quite common to call someone anally retentive for being tidy. And I think it's a real shame that we've kind of completely lost anally expulsive as such a brilliant term for people who just talk absolute crap.
Now, I wanted to start, Lauren, if you will, by showing you some pictures. And would you be able to describe them for our listeners?
Okay. Are you psychoanalysing me?
No.
Okay, good.
Okay, so here's the first one.
Of a decayed foot.
Oh my god.
I don't know. Is that attached to someone who's still alive?
Yeah.
I think, yeah.
Is that really unpleasant?
That is a gangrenous toe.
First three toes. What is that one?
Oh!
Miranda, what is that?
They're showing us a picture of a toilet that seems to not only be overflowing, but have a sort of embodied shit monster coming from it. Showing us someone with a rotten mouth, rotten teeth.
It's pretty disgusting. Okay, so that was an interesting experiment.
Which one do you think was the worst?
No, I can't. I can see them all.
No, they've gone now. They've gone. It's fine. But what was really interesting there is that you all made the disgust face. You did this. It's something you do almost as though you're about to retch. It's a wrinkly nose. You kind of stick your lips out a bit. You all right? Do you need a moment?
Yeah, I'm all right. It's just really not pleasant.
It's okay.
I don't know if I might see it again in a second.
Okay, there you go. That's it. Picture round is over. Okay.
That was the worst picture
round. So when I was trying...
I do not like this round.
Jeremy Paxman just sent some nice pictures of Renaissance art. What's wrong with you?
I did it because I was trying to disgust you.
Congratulations.
Okay.
A filthy room would have sufficed.
Because I want to talk about the social theory of disgust. Because I don't think many people realise that disgust is one of the main drivers of human behaviour. So it's been pretty well established that before we developed a theory of disease, disgust protected us by making us shy away from biologically harmful things like gangrenous people, vomit, feces, rotting meat, all the things I've just shown you. And I do apologise for that, but I was trying to set the scene. But recent research has actually shown this, that disgust is an even more powerful emotion than we previously thought. And I think this is really interesting. So as humanity developed, disgust started to influence our social behaviour, not just our physical behaviour. So as well as causing us to shun things that we know are going to harm us, like poo and, you know, vomit and dead rats, it's causing us to shun people, anyone who we suspect is going to be a carrier of disease, any sort of behaviour that we judge to be risky. And that's where it gets difficult, because then social theories of disgust become complicated by the fact that it takes on a connection to morality. And there have been some really terrifying studies that have illustrated the ways that disgust can influence our notions of right and wrong. So one study showed, this is one of my absolute favourites that I found, that placing people in a dirty, smelly room, and they do it with, like, they get fart spray and spray it around the
fart
room.
Fart spray, because that's the product you can buy.
No, they had to develop it.
Should we get some for
specially?
Free? No, let's get some fart spray.
They developed it specially. I read a fascinating article about how they developed it. And then they sit them down at a really dirty desk, and then they ask them sort of moral questions, like, is it morally okay to eat your dead pet dog? And apparently, if it's a clean room, the dead dog gets eaten, that's no props. But if it's a dirty room, when you're feeling subconsciously more susceptible to disease, because you're like, ooh, that's all yucky, then it's not okay and the pet dog gets a decent burial.
I mean, that's fascinating, but I'm also slightly disturbed by these evil scientists who are doing a study where they shut people in the room, spray farts on them, and say, eat your pet!
Chesky, it gets more sinister, because same study proved that smelly rooms make you more judgmental about things like homosexual sex. So things that we
would
consider a real moral judgment, that you're making. So you'd like to think that we make moral judgments based on sort of pros and cons, arriving at a balanced judgment, but apparently that isn't the case. We're actually really susceptible to our environment. And that's really troubling when you think that we try and repel things that we're disgusted by. So if you think about Nazi propaganda depicting Jewish people as filthy rats, you know, that really famous sort of posters. And do you want to know, just bringing it back to contemporary politics, someone who's particularly easily disgusted? Donald Trump. Okay. Mm-hmm. So in his biography,
someone who reads on prostitutes, he's amazingly disgusted.
He admits to being an obsessive hand washer. He won't touch lift buttons because he thinks they're dirty. And apparently he used to pre-test his dates for AIDS. We need to consider that studies have also shown that the more easily disgusted you are, the more politically conservative you're likely to be. It kind of makes sense. And if you look at some of his speeches, the way he uses language really plays on this idea of disgust. So I've just got a quote now from one where he says, it's coming from... I'm not going to do an American accent.
Do it.
No, I can't do it. It's coming from more than Mexico. It's coming from all over South and Latin America. And it's coming probably from the Middle East. The US has become a dumping ground for everyone else's problems. He's playing on this idea of like infection, disease, disgust. And he's generating this response in people that's like, oh, gross. So his success isn't based on effective policies. It's based on a really clever manipulation of our natural disgust mechanism. And ironically, I find him pretty disgusting myself. So that's it.
That's fascinating.
Oh my God. That was a really difficult...
Yeah, sorry. I feel like I've really upset everyone.
Both of you have... Oh my gosh. That's so... So, right, explain to me why... How do they link the disgust of homosexuality and being in a dirty room? Like,
it's really complex, and I don't think they've got all the answers
yet. And also, who were they? Who were these people?
These evil scientists!
Who were they? Who did this?
No, they were from excellent institutions. I think the woman who did that was a woman from Cambridge who did the homosexual smelly room one. But it just really frightened me. And then I read this really fascinating study about how people could potentially use it to manipulate your political kind of leanings even further by putting like stinky things outside polling stations. But one other thing I thought was particularly interesting about it was that while it's this theory of disgust has been proven really successful in making us dislike things, and it's not actually that successful in making us do positive things. So obviously we all know that you're meant to wash your hands after you take a shit or go for a piss. But apparently only one in five people do it.
After you anally expulse.
After you anally expulse. But they've tried all sorts of kind of propaganda campaigns, you know, of showing flies on shit, spreading diseases. Apparently it just doesn't work to try and make us do something positive that will protect ourselves. It'll only make us do something to harm other people.
I don't like when people use OCD in the wrong...
No, I don't like that.
I don't like when people go, oh, I'm really OCD about being clean. And I really don't like that. But I know that I have a level of my own personality that is obsessive about... I can, like, wash my hands quite a few times. This is maybe sharing far too much. But because of germs, and because once I saw one of those, like... I can't remember what the TV programme was, but it was something about, you know, one of those TV doctors that were like, let's bring these people in to see how... I can't remember whether it was a TV show, but like, how clean are you? As opposed to like, how clean is your house?
How clean is your house? How clean are you?
Oh, but I love...
Scan you down.
I obviously love how clean is your house anyway. I love that sort of Kim and Aggie
programme. That makes me really anxious.
But it does make me feel quite stressed. Apparently there were high levels of faeces in people's hair.
What?
It like somebody got tested and there was high levels of their own feces in their hair because they don't wash their hands properly.
Well, one in five apparently don't.
And I bite my nails and I'm thinking, I have touched things and put my fingers in my mouth. Maybe I am obsessive about cleaning and I am just coming to realise this. But my own
poo. Sorry, I brought it up again.
My own poo I'd look at. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. You always
you
have a look.
You look at your own poo.
I have a look.
Do you not?
But like German toilets have a special shelf, don't they? Yeah. So that you're meant to look.
Why?
I think you should look.
You're meant to have a little look to check its health before it goes.
Well, yeah, I think it's German toilets that rather than it just going into the abyss, it falls on a little shelf. That the idea is that you turn around and have a look at it before you flush, sort of say goodbye.
Much easier. And,
you know? I don't think it's in the last post.
I would probably be on paper reasonably anally retentive, but maybe I could say because I had a problem with my bowels for such a long time medically. Mm. I don't know, you don't have to keep that in the podcast, but what's interesting, one of the weirdest points in my whole life was having to, when I had to get tested 10 years later for celiac disease, and they were like, we'll need to take blood tests. God love our NHS, but they lost all my blood tests and they also lost my stool sample.
Oh no! It's still out there somewhere.
Someone's got it. But I've got this horrible feeling because my friend said to me that she had to do a stool sample and she did it at home and then carried it to the doctors. And I was like, I'm not doing that because there's a chance that like a dog will take my bag or somebody will rob me. I don't know, like a dog will...
Has like, that ever happened?
No, but it could do. They might be like, oh, treats. I don't know. my food smells great. I don't know. But I turned up at the doctors and I was like, no, safety. I'll do it at the doctors. So I did it. I did it in a bag, I mean, and then did it triple bagged.
That's quite an organisation that you made yourself need a poo.
Well, I waited hospital. For a long time, and then I did it at the doctors, and then handed it over, and it disappeared. And obviously, I was like, "Excuse me," and she was like, "Oh, what's this?" And I was like, "It's." I didn't know whether to say stool or poo or feces. I didn't know what the correct terminology was. I was like, "I'm pooed. I'm shitting a bag. I'm sorry. I don't know what the right fumbled over it. Obviously, not over the poo." It was loose. No. So I handed it over the counter.
A handful of poo.
Okay, so the next set of cultural precedents we have for you, Lauren, are the social and cultural ones. And I'm going to kick off, and I'd like to talk about fetishizing vacuum cleaners. Okay. So who here has got a vacuum cleaner? Chesky, you've got one?
I really love my vacuum cleaner as well, to a point that might be a bit creepy.
Okay, well, maybe we'll talk about that later. Lauren, have you got one?
I do, yeah.
Yeah, Nigel?
Probably.
Okay, I've got one as well.
Probably.
Nigel.
You've got a cleaner.
You've gone up in the world since
entitled. So between us, we've all got maybe one each. But none of us compare to 34-year-old vacuum cleaner repairman James Brown from Derbyshire, the holder of the Guinness World Record for the largest vacuum cleaner collection. Brown's got more than 322 cleaners.
Why?
Which is double, double his closest rival. And a quote from James Brown here, "All I've ever wanted is to work with vacuum cleaners. I suppose I'm the ultimate clean freak." And as a nation, I think we can all be very proud of him. But...
why was he not in the Olympic opening ceremony? Leading out with his vacuum cleaner.
I don't know. He should have been. What a man. What a man, the legend, James Brown. Woo! So the first manual vacuum cleaners were developed in the 1860s. And then the first motorised ones began appearing at the beginning of the 20th century. And now the earlier models are really collectible. And if you're a fan of vacuum cleaners, as apparently Chesky is, you can join the Vacuum Cleaner Collectors Club. Yeah, who describe themselves, and I've spent some time on their website this week, as a non-profit collectors group dedicated to the preservation and restoration of an integral part of industrial history. They were founded in 1983, and they now have over 100 members, and they hold an annual convention.
I'm sold. I'm going.
Events at this year's convention included displays of members' personal collections, a cleaning competition, and a pool party.
A what party?
A pool party.
What, in a swimming pool?
Yeah.
With the vacuum cleaners?
Yeah, just for funds. So I'm just trying to emphasise the social element.
I'm just saying, like, if you take your vacuum cleaner to a swimming pool, it's all going to go horribly wrong. Unless it's a wet and dry model.
What do you... Like, are they just collecting them?
Well, we're going to get onto this.
We'll discuss that. Okay. Sorry.
So it does seem that most of the members are men. And I've got some pictures of the members, Lauren. Don't worry, these aren't going to frighten you, but I'd just like you to maybe describe a couple to our viewers. So here's number one.
Oh, wow.
If you could maybe talk the viewers through what you're seeing there.
Can I just say before Lauren says anything that I'm deeply aroused?
As am I. Is he American?
Yeah.
Okay. He is American. Why do I know that?
I think it's the moustache.
The moustache. He's got quite high-waisted jeans with a... Oh, wow. I mean, he just looks like a man who knows what he's doing with that.
It's quite an authoritative pose,
yeah,
isn't it?
His hat's at a jaunty angle, which means he's fun.
He's beautifully lit.
He's very...
There's a great sidelight.
Is there something... on his rug there, or is that what's happening?
I think he's got a rug on a carpet.
For our listeners, he is clothed. They are referring to a rug on the floor.
Or as a sort of sexy cowboy.
I think this is the new calendar.
Mm. Yeah. So they are mostly male. And the website is actually very clear that this isn't a sexual thing.
But even the fact they felt the need to point that out suggests that it is.
But it does all come across as quite fetishistic. And if you look up vacuum cleaner porn, and I don't recommend you do.
But we're going to do it.
Well, not necessarily. But you will get some frightening things. But if you think, okay, so I'm going to bring this back to Karl Marx, as I like to bring all things back to Karl Marx.
Off we go.
So he borrowed the term fetish, obviously, to characterise the cult object of capitalism, the commodity. And he even went so far as to assign the commodity with a feminine personality. He described it as giving amorous glances to consumers.
Worst fetish party I've ever been to. Loads of Marxists standing around talking about objects.
By the 1930s, I think we're all like familiar with the like shake and vac adverts and this idea of the vacuum cleaner as the ultimate kind of new technological consumer commodity. The vacuum cleaner is giving amorous glances left, right and centre. It is flirting.
I mean, if it's a Henry Hoover, it's got eyes.
I was going to say, Henrietta Hoover.
Well, exactly. But if you really think about it, like, why are they sexual? Vacuum cleaners are a bit sexually confusing. So they're associated with femininity. And if you read a lot of the interviews, as I now have, with people from the Vacuum Cleaner Collectors Club, a lot of the reasons they give for being attracted to vacuum cleaners is this association with the sort of ideal of feminine domesticity. And they always bring it back to their mothers and hearing the sound of their mothers vacuuming. So they're associated with femininity and their primary function is sucking. So that's quite sexy. But also, they have a big, long phallic hose. Baffling. I thought I'd like to end, Chesky, if you could get it out, by showing you some vacuum cleaner porn. So this is one of the members. We're going to watch it. It's Don't worry, it's not graphic.
No, it's great.
Unless you're very into vacuum cleaners. And this is something you can... It's a whole category of videos on YouTube that you can go and look off. You search particularly for Hoover convertible demonstration. You'll get a lot of this stuff coming up.
Hopefully it will load.
Oh no, what is he going to do?
This is one of my favourites that I found. This particular YouTuber has hundreds of videos. He's got a lot of Hoovers. He's also got some of hand dryers and lifts.
We haven't searched for it, but there was a video that came up once that we watched, and because we've talked about getting a carpet cleaner, and then we watched like somebody do a carpet, and the two of us, oh my god, I am giving too much insight into my own personal relationship. You need to edit this out. But we watched it, and I was like, and both of us were like, that is so satisfying. Why is that a satisfying thing to look at something
dirty? Have you watched videos of people jet washing things?
Oh.
That is so satisfying.
No.
I want to jet wash my life. Ooh. It's amazing. They jet wash things and like all the dirt goes away. It's all pure and lovely. It's not jet washed though.
No.
Okay. Well, so that's fetishizing vacuum cleaners. Chesky, what are you going to come back at us with?
Well, I also went into a deep, dark place of the internet.
Yeah.
And I want to talk to you about sissy maids. I am somebody who, you know, I have a split personality because I'm a neat freak. I want things, I want to indulge nulling. I want to put everything at right angles. I want things to be incredibly clean, incredibly tidy. I also love stuff. My house is full of stuff.
And my husband is incredibly messy and gets things out of bins and just leaves them all over the place. So I've never been able to indulge in the Muji fantasy house that I've always wanted to live in. But perhaps a potential solution to my dreams would be for me to get some outside help. I did try getting a cleaner, but I was utterly shamed by my middle class guilt of having too much stuff that I would first have to get rid of the stuff that so they were able to clean. But then the actual cleaner that I did have threatened to dispatch my pet lizard with the dustbuster, which I found quite disturbing.
No, Morph!
Yeah, she was a bit scary. So perhaps I could go one better and actually have someone pay me to come and clean my house. What I need is a sissy maid. Sissy maids, not to be confused with trans identities or cross-dressing, you know, to actually appear as a woman, is linked to femdom, feminization, and sissification. I will be explaining these. Where a male submissive switches gender to serve a usually female mistress. Sissy maids are treated as childlike. For example, the mistresses are usually referred to as auntie, with the suggestion that their feminization is forced upon them. Like, ooh, I'm going to make him look like a pretty girl. The act of making the sissy clean is duofold. Inducting them into the boudoir, the female sacred space, by letting them clean it. But, you know, I'm not actually being part of it as a woman, they're just allowed to inhabit it. But also forcing them to perform a task traditionally cast as feminine, but also subservient. The sissy maid will typically wear the frilly French costume of the maid, as we think of it, an eroticised version of the historic servant's attire, linked to the fetish of petticoating, also known as pinaforing, where a man is forced to wear sort of very frilly, very feminine clothes as an act of humiliation, and perhaps might also be made to play with dolls or tea sets, you know, to enact a very stereotypical view of femininity in a mode to humiliate them to male peers and emasculate them. The costume of the maid goes further, as it already implies a power dynamic between slave and master. You can find out a lot more about this in the fantastic Petticoat Discipline Quarterly by Auntie Helga. I want Auntie Helga to be my best friend. She's amazing. Which has excellent advice as how to treat your houseboy when you are to dress them as a sissy maid. Quote, that has proved very effective at deflating uppity members of the male sex. At Petticoat Discipline Quarterly, we believe that if it were more widely employed, then boys and men would be far more docile and respectful to females. There would be much less crime, and divorce courts would be seldom used. End quote. I mean, I think Auntie Helga's got a point. You know, if more men were forced into petticoats, then this would be a good plan. However, a practical problem arises that although sissy maids are... However, there is a practical problem in that most sissy maids are purposefully really actually quite bad at cleaning, hoping that it will result in punishment, such as spanking. Although there is a sub-fetish, excuse the pun, sub-fetish.
Wow, you have had to explain all your puns today.
I'm not sure punning comes naturally to me.
No.
Of Nancy maids, and my favourite, Cinderfellas.
Oh, yeah. That sounds lovely. What's a Cinderfella?
Well, they're actually put to domestic work and they're good at it, as opposed to failing on purpose to be
punished. Is that just actual cleaners?
Yeah, well, sexy cleaners who like cleaning. Their fetish is cleaning.
But are they naked?
Well, you know, who cares? Oh. The oven's nice, I don't mind.
Well, now Chesky is looking at me throughout this.
Well, we did very briefly have a sissy maid, didn't we?
Let me explain. So I had an accidental party once and some people came back to my house after an event and I was putting makeup on all the boys for funsies. And then one particular guy got really into it and he expressed a desire to fulfill this fantasy to me. And because I've got a lot of ridiculous clothes, I dressed him up in my blue frilly princess lace tiered gown. And I tried to put him to some cleaning tasks to see, well, this is great. As we've discussed, I'm very into material culture. I collect a lot. I've got a lot of knickknacks and fripperies.
that shit needs dusting. So I gave him the pledge and a duster. But I actually just found it really frustrating because he wouldn't clean anything. He kept trying to make it sexual, and I was just not interested in that at all because I didn't fancy him, so I wasn't going for that. But he was just doing a really poor job on the mahogany.
So, Lauren, you've heard from us on the historical, which for me was extreme minimalism that would lead you potentially to self-mummification.
From me, you heard a literary history of hoarding.
Theoretical, you heard
social theories of disgust from me.
And Freudian anal retentiveness and expulsion. And finally, for social cultural, I had sissy maids, and Miranda had...
I had fetishising the vacuum cleaner.
And out of these six things, Lauren, which one has caught your attention today?
Oh, just pick one thing out of the six that's my favourite. Yeah. All right.
Have a little deliberation.
So let's think about it. So my favourite one was... I'm so scared about making the wrong choice. Oh, God. Okay, my favourite one was the disgust. Can I have a
round? There are two people here.
No, but also I really very close second was the anally retentive thing, and then thirdly, I'm gonna go home and watch loads of videos about cleaning. I'm obsessed. Vacuum cleaner porn.
Miranda, you are victorious with your emotional blackmail of showing us disgusting
images. Truly disgusting. But thank you very much, Lauren. So as the cultural historian of the month, I think it just leaves me to say thank you very much to our guest, Lauren Silver.
Thank you, Lauren. You were splendid.
For listening to our disgusting stories.
Thanks.
And thank you to our producer, Nigel. And if you would like to follow us on Twitter or engage with us anyway, or
see pictures of gangrenous toes.
Oh my God.
Yeah. More puns. No more puns.
Listen to Chesky's puns or look at pictures of gangrenous toes. Our Twitter is @occulthistoryof. And you can also find us on Facebook with the same name. So thanks very much for listening, and do come back next month.
You have been listening to This Is a Cultural History Of, presented by Miranda Garrett and Chesky Peschier. Produced by Nigel Doyle-Rush with the voice of Trent Fleming.